This is SiriusXM's POTUS, Channel 124. Welcome to this special presentation in partnership with the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the United States Senate, a conversation between former Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri and former Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. Now, here's your host, Steve Scully.
Senators, welcome to Boston. Welcome to the EMK Institute. Do you feel at home?
Well, when I walked in earlier before we all got here, I had a chance to come in and just look around, and it's stunningly like the Senate. And I went over and stood behind my desk right there in the middle of the second row, where I was sitting by Lindsey Graham on one side and Senator Cornyn on the other. But most senators move every 2 years, and everything's done by seniority. And if you're the 100th senator, you get to sit in the desk that's left when everybody else has a desk. But it's a great accomplishment and a great way to have a sense of what the Senate's like and what happens there.
Senator Heitkamp?
Well, the interesting thing is I was the 100th senator. So whatever was left, which was way back in that corner over there, but the 99th, I think at the time, was Mazie Hirono. We were elected at the same time, and we became fast friends, and she was my ohana, which means family in Hawaiian, and we decided we would never part. We would always sit next to each other. So it limited options when we were looking at moving, but sat over there. In fact, I think Elizabeth Warren sat behind us. Kamala Harris sat behind us. So the back bench was actually better than the middle seats. So I had the little kid's seat.
So why was she 99 and you were 100?
Because North Dakota is a smaller state than Hawaii. And so it goes first by seniority, and you get ranked, which I'm bitter about because I'm a former attorney general, but if you were governor, you got extra points in seniority when you looked at how seniority rankings went. And so when you're a former attorney general tax commissioner from a state that is one of the smallest states in the union, you get to be 100th. And so I have a license plate that says 100, and there's some bragging rights to that.
There's some bragging rights that, and if you're a House member, you get to count, you that counts as well. But if you're a former senator, so when I came to the Senate, Dan Coats was coming back to the Senate, and so he outranked all of us since he was a former senator. And then Jerry Moran and I from Kansas had gone to the House together, so we had the same amount of service, Jerry had to draw out of an envelope, and he drew the wrong number, so I was always senior to Jerry, and all the time we were in the Senate together, but he's still there, so he's senior to me now.
And we were in earlier, and of course, the most important desk is right over there, correct?
The candy desk, and started by, you had a candy desk on your side as well?
Absolutely.
I was never allowed to get close to that desk, I guess.
Well, welcome.
You could have come over anytime.
I did.
We'll talk about the election in a moment, but Senator Blunt, I want to begin with you because, as you know, the role of the Senate is advise and consent. We are now in the middle of some pretty fierce confirmation debates. You have a new Senate Republican leader, somebody who you worked with, John Thune. So how does he navigate a Trump presidency 2.0, some nominees that are going to be contentious, and ensuring that the Senate does its duty to advise and consent?
Well, I do think the consent part is an important part of that, and sometimes just give advice, and the advice normally turns out to be, we really don't think this person is up to the job, but that doesn't happen very often. Usually that person doesn't get to the Senate floor for whatever reason. Something comes up, their name's withdrawn. Seldom does that happen. My rule normally, Steve, and I think this will be the rule for most Republicans, if not most people in the Senate, my rule was that a president gets a lot of leeway here. And if it's somebody that's coming in and leaving when the president leaves, I tried my best to be for that person, whether it was a Democrat president or a Republican. If it was somebody that coming in for life, like a judge, or for a 10-year term on a commission or something, I looked at them in a different way than I did the people that were going to be literally there only when the president was there. And I think generally the people that I would have opposed never actually made it to, they either didn't get out of the committee to come to the floor, or they often, somebody like that winds up having withdrawing their name or being asked to withdraw their name by the president, or he withdraws their name before you ever have a chance to make that vote. I think the Senate wants the committees to look at the nominees closely. I think they will do that. There's a process that goes on where you're looked at by usually the FBI. There's a little controversy on that right now, but I think the Senate will look at these members and look at these nominees, and all of them for various reasons will not be nominated. But normally, I think the president does get a lot of leeway here, who he wants to be part of his administration.
But Senator Heitkamp, the other part of this debate, the possibility of recess appointments, we saw that immediately after the election, it could come to the forefront when the new Congress takes office in January. What are your concerns?
Well, I mean, I think when you look at kind of the nomination process, I'm with Roy. They have to give me a reason, a really, really strong reason, to oppose a nominee for a cabinet position in particular. The president got elected. He's entitled to his team. That doesn't mean that there aren't disqualifying factors. And so I think that a lot of the recessed appointment talk went away with Gates. I think there was enough pushback from members of the Republican Party that it was questionable, even if John Thune had tried to take it to recess, he needed a majority of his party to recess the Senate. I'm not sure he would have gotten that. And so I think that that has been a calibrating moment. You don't hear the president-elect, former President Trump, talking right now about recessed appointments, but you do see a push to shorten the kind of scrutiny that may ordinarily come. Now, you might think that an FBI background check is somehow magically in the books, that this has to be done. That's, again, a norm that we've had for a lot of years that looks like now may go by the wayside. Question is whether the committee chairs or whether the minority will ask for kind of background checks. Obviously, the FBI will not be an agency during that time period that will be controlled by Chris Wray. Likely that will even if he doesn't get a confirmation of his FBI person, he could in fact terminate the tenure of Christopher Wray. And so I think that there's a lot of what ifs, and this is a big job for John Thune, which is trying to figure out how he is going to support his president, which quite honestly every senator or leader in a majority party that has a president in your party, they have to consider supporting their president. But you also have to consider the prerogatives of Article 1, advise and consent. And what does it mean if you simply rubber stamp and don't go through the process, these nominees? And I think the one thing that Roy may disagree with me on is this is a process that if you approve someone who later on something comes out about them that you didn't know, that has peril for the senator that voted for confirmation. Now with that, I would tell you I voted for every one of Trump's original cabinet members, most of which we knew, you know, whether it was Jeff Sessions or whether it was Rex Tillerson, who I knew from his work in the oil and gas industry. The only one I didn't vote for was Betsy DeVos. I didn't think she had the background, and I think education is so critical. But so she still got confirmed. I think all of his nominees got confirmed. I don't think they withdrew anyone in that first go-around, and we've already seen one withdrawal.
So let me go back to the earlier question. What advice do you give John Thune? Because he has a really delicate balancing act of being loyal to Donald Trump, but also I would say he is somebody who really adheres to the institution and wants to preserve the role of the Senate.
Well, I think that's the advice. You need to preserve the role of the Senate. And there's a reason the Senate is the Congress is Article One in the Constitution, and you need to honor that preeminence that the Constitution gives the Congress. We've lost a lot of that in the last 50 years, but there's more and more interest, I think, in restoring the job of the Congress to the Congress. But the Congress has to be willing to do its job. But I would just say the explanation here was really pretty good. You have an obligation to the Senate, but you also have an obligation to the president of your party if you're the majority leader and the president is of your party.
So because we are here in this replica of the Senate, which is magnificent and beautiful and really a testament to the U.S. Senate, I want to get into some of the policy areas and the procedures, including regular order. And this is something that you, Senator Heitkamp, have been very fervent on, returning to the committee process, returning to regular order, not letting two or four House and Senate leaders dictate the budget, which has happened. Congress has not passed a budget on time since 1996, when Bill Clinton was in the White House and Newt Gingrich was Speaker. How do we get back to regular order?
Let me tell you, that is one of the primary reasons why the favorabilities of the United States Congress are in maybe double digits, maybe. And our friend John McCain can say, why so high? Why so high? You know, the bottom line is, and I'll just tell it from my perspective, when I got to the United States Senate, I assumed I would be voting. You would assume I'd be voting. America assumes the Senate votes. And yet, I mean, Harry Reid was the majority leader, and we weren't voting on anything, literally. I mean, and it was finally, Claire McCaskill called it the Haiti insurrection. Finally, I just said, I came to vote. I came to do stuff. I didn't come to just sit in a chair and have people, you know, whatever, glorify this job, sitting in this chair down here, if we're not legislating, if we're not debating, if we're not talking about the issues of the day, which honestly, everybody criticizes C-SPAN because they say, oh, it's when the cameras came in, things didn't get done. I don't think that's true. I think when the cameras came in, that's when Congress, or when the institution plummeted in terms of favorability, not because they were doing too much, because all they saw was an empty chamber. All they saw was nothing, you know, quorum calls. And so I went to Harry and I said, you know, can we just vote? And he goes, you know, Heidi, there's a lot of issues people don't want to take a vote on. And I said, you know what, Harry? I am the most vulnerable Democrat in this entire chamber, and if I say I'll vote, then everybody should be willing to vote, right? And so one of the problems, I think, when you look at leadership in the Senate is that they do two things. Number one, myopically focus on protecting the executive if the executive is of their political party. Number two, protecting their majority at the risk of not getting anything done, because anytime you get things done, guess what? You got 51% of the people happy and 49% unhappy. And I think the last thing, and I think the most important part of this is, there was a time when the leaders of the Senate led the Senate. They were not political leaders. They represented the institution that got things done. And I think Ted Kennedy comes from that tradition. Somebody who said, fine, I didn't get to be president, guess what? I'm gonna take maximum advantage to get things done in the United States Senate. John McCain on the other side, didn't get to be president. Maximum advantage of getting things done. And when the leadership is myopically focused on protecting their majority as opposed to getting things done, nothing gets done. And so, and the public is not served, and Article One perishes. Withers on the vine, because executive authority will move right into that void, and understandably so.
And Senator Blunt, speaking of nothing getting done, as you well know, because you served in the House and in the Senate, the biggest divide in Washington is often not between the White House and the president, between Democrats and Republicans. It is between the House and the Senate. How do you fix that?
Well, I think you fix it in a lot by just letting people be part of the system. You know, the whole idea of regular order is that what you learn in the civics class about how the Congress is supposed to work. You have committees that know more about the topic of their committee, hopefully, than anybody else in the Congress does. They pass a bill. They try to amend the bill. They have a vigorous debate on the bill. They have a chance to take that bill to the floor and defend it again to the other members. The House does the same thing. You have a conference committee. You know, I was in the House for 14 years and the Senate for 12. So in the 26 years I was there, really, even the first couple of years in the Senate still functioned largely like it had in the past. And then the leaders, frankly, in my view, took over. And I've said this publicly. I've said it to every one of them. I've said it to many press conferences, that if you don't let the members be part of the work, then they don't honor the work. They honor the fight. And too many people now run for the fight rather than the job. You know, because, well, frankly, when they get there, all they get to do is be part of the fight. For a long time, for 220 or so years, the principal job of the Congress was to set the priorities of the country by determining how we spend our money. That's how you set your priority at home. It's how you set your priority in the government. And, you know, we would take those 12 appropriations bills, all of them to the floor, occasionally one a couple at a time. Health and education bills, the biggest besides defense. It's the most controversial. And we would spend 2 and sometimes 3 weeks on the House floor when I was the whip of the House debating that one bill. And the rule at the time was any member could bring any amendment they wanted to as long as they paid for it by taking the money from something else in that bill or not spending, just taking the money away. And by the time you got a couple of weeks into that bill, one, people understood it. Two, they had more appreciation for how hard it was to bring that to the floor. And three, they had a chance to do whatever they wanted to do and find out how many people agree with you. And, you know, when you got 100 senators or you've got 200 and you've got 435 House members and only 10 of them agree with you, you got to think, well, maybe that wasn't such a good amendment after all. I see why it didn't get out of the committee, because nobody was willing to agree that that was what we ought to do. And so buying into the process, honoring the committee work, giving the members something to do that is part of what they're supposed to do would benefit the House, the Senate, and the country in a significant way. And the leaders need to figure that out. Too many times now, the two Senate leaders, the two House leaders, and about a dozen staffers get in this star chamber and come up with one big bill that never gets debated, that nobody knows what's in it till it's passed. But it is essential to fund the government. So if you're a member who wasn't part of that, you know, barely a majority usually pass that bill, and that's what it takes to keep the government functioning.
Senator Heitkamp, the filibuster is not in the Constitution. It dates back to, what, 1806, and we've come a long way from, you know, Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or Strom Thurmond and the marathon, what, 24, 25-hour debate that he had in the filibuster in the 1950s. Some have said it's a relic of the past. Others say it protects the minority. Should it stay? Should it be nixed? What is your view?
I made my view pretty well known when I signed a letter after, after Harry changed the rules on court nominations, then we signed a letter saying on substantive bills we were not going to change the filibuster. That quickly, a lot of people who signed that letter, they didn't stay with that position. So I am a big believer that on final passage in particular, a 60-vote majority is, it hasn't been necessary across history. And the filibuster now is a weapon, has been weaponized. by a lot of people to try and have their say or to try and stop things. That shouldn't happen. That's a norm that has been violated. But at the end of the day, when you pass a bill with 60 votes, it has a lot more staying power. And one of the things that you're going to see, I think, especially since we've been governing by executive order, whether it is on healthcare premium issues or whether it's on student loan forgiveness, whatever it might be, because those things haven't made their way through. There's no permanency to them. And so a 60-vote majority on really important bills like reforming Dodd-Frank, which is one that we did when I was there, those give it a gravitas that they wouldn't otherwise have and a permanency that they wouldn't otherwise have. And I think they're better bills. And so I know it's frustrating to the public, but what you ought to be concerned about is people who have weaponized a filibuster, who filibuster everything. And the reaction from leadership, again, because they have more control, if that bill doesn't come to the floor, they can always do the backroom deal. I mean, they don't have any real need to burn up the clock to do any of this legislation. So there's never any push because you can filibuster a motion to proceed and never even hear about the bill again. And that shouldn't happen. So we should be able to do filibuster reform that gives the American public the idea of what is being debated, what's being talked about. But on final passage, I would not change the filibuster.
Senators, you know, and you were on the Senate floor when Harry Reid invoked the nuclear option when it came to judicial nominees. He basically said, look, your party was blocking everything. He needed to do something to move this Senate through. Was that a mistake?
Of course, it was a mistake. And what he really wanted to do was pack the D.C. Circuit Court. There were no Supreme Court vacancies. That court had a lot of vacancies. Harry wanted to fill them, and he wanted to fill them with 51 votes instead of 60. On the filibuster generally, I chaired the Rules Committee a majority of the time I was in the Senate, I think about 6 of the 12 years, maybe 8. And I proposed some changes where we would get to the bill easier, debate the bill with 51 votes, but I agree totally with Heidi on the importance of 60 votes is you do wind up with legislation that is more in the middle. There have never been 60 popularly elected Republicans. I think 56 is the highest number ever. There have only been 60 Democrats a handful of times, and that goes all the way back to the Great Depression when we had those big numbers of Democrats for a long time. But if you have to get 60 people, that almost always means you have to have at least somebody on the other side, on your side. And it just changes the character of the debate. If somebody on the other side is for a bill, it makes it hard for the entire opposite side to attack everybody who voted for the bill, for instance. And it creates a great permanency in the House that passes a lot of things with a majority that never become law. The next Congress comes in and they pass the opposite bills. And that's what would happen to the law itself if you didn't have the safeguard of the Senate of almost insisting that there be some element of bipartisan cooperation before you have a bill that goes to the president's desk, and that's a good thing.
You're listening to POTUS, SiriusXM Channel 124.
And on the SiriusXM app.
Politics from all points of view. This is SiriusXM's POTUS, Channel 124. Welcome back to the special conversation on the start of the 119th Congress and the future of the United States Senate. Here's your host, Steve Scully.
So let's talk about the character of Supreme Court nominees, and certainly Ted Kennedy was front and center with the Robert Bork confirmation, which was very contentious, that led to Justice Scalia, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan. As you both know, when he passed away, a 10, almost 11-month period between his death and a nomination that was held up by your Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, and then, of course, 4 years later, a very different situation because Amy Coney Barrett was fast-forward through, 4, 5, 6 weeks. And Mitch McConnell has said, look, Democrats would have done the same thing. But just looking at it in terms of the institution, let me begin with you, Senator Blunt. Your thoughts on how that impacted the politics of the Senate and the Supreme Court.
Well, in the end of the first 2 years of the Bush administration, I think once you get to year three, Democrats in control of the Senate, Senator Schumer was not the majority leader, but he led this particular fight, and he announced there's not a Supreme Court vacancy yet, but if there is, I'm just telling you, we're not going to fill it until after this presidential election. So there's no question that both sides would look at those late things that way if they're in the majority. If you're in the majority and there's an opportunity to fill a vacancy, they would both try to do that as well. You could argue that changing the rules to where 51 could do that clearly made a difference. But once those rules get changed, they don't get changed back, which was why on that, you know, when Senator Reid changed the rules to 51, Senator McConnell at the time said, you'll be sorry you did this, and you may be sorry sooner than you think. And within 18 months, Republicans were in the majority, and they had the tool that had been used against them now that they could use on their own, and they did.
But what about the delay with the Merrick Garland appointment and the lightning speed of Amy Coney Barrett?
That's what either majority would do. If you didn't do that and you were in the majority, you essentially would have failed to do what you're expected to do if you're in the majority.
I think if anyone thought that in November, or let's say October, there was a death in the Supreme Court, that there wouldn't have been a nomination pushed through the Democratic Senate, you're not living the political reality. I think the real challenge here and the real shame of all of this change, even for the down ballot, which I voted for, when you're giving a lifetime appointment to someone, there should be more scrutiny than a four-year political appointment. And I would tell you that to fix this problem, you need to get rid of lifetime appointments of judges.
Including the Supreme Court.
I totally agree. I think they should be term limited. Because I think that I've checked the constitutionality. That's of dubious constitutional. But I would want to advance the argument. And I will tell you this, because once you give someone a lifetime appointment, what's been happening, the nominees are younger and younger and younger, and you end up with judges that don't know much, that maybe not even tried a case, and now they're sitting on the federal bench because they fill a political slot. And so to me, rather than worrying about the appointment stuff, because you can't have a system where the Senate is controlled by one party and the president by another, and you don't appoint any judges. I mean, that's where we're headed. And I think if you if there wasn't permanency to the decision, I think that there would be a lot, the appointment process would be easier. And I will tell you, this is a personal story. I got a lot of criticism back home for not voting for Justice Kavanaugh. And when people ask me, well, you voted for a lot of political appointees that you didn't agree with, I said, but none of them had a lifetime appointment. I wasn't making that decision for today. I wasn't even making it for 4 years from now. I was making it for 30, 40 years. And to me, you know, that person has to be above reproach in order for me to give the good housekeeping seal of approval.
And of course, we could be going through this next year. Pretty good chance that Donald Trump will have one, perhaps two more Supreme Court nominees in his term in the White House. What about the idea of having term limits or age limits for Supreme Court justices?
Well, you know, age varies from person to person. I don't think I'm for either term limits or age limits. The Constitution tried to remove the judges from the political pressure of terms or election, either one, and I think that's served us pretty well.
I think if you said 20 years and out, that's plenty. You've had your time on the bench. The other thing about the Supreme Court, and I will say this, and it's always bothered me, there are no ethical responsibility. They set their own ethics. And I think you have to have a sense of taking a look at what's happened, taking a look at the kind of latitude that Supreme Court justices have who are deciding cases compared to what a senator can do under ethics is like day and night.
But the Chief Justice would say, look, three separate but equal branches of government, and we will monitor our judges, and you do the Senate.
They should do a better job monitoring their judges. That's the point. When an institution fails to respond to legitimate concerns about ethical issues, then all of a sudden people look for workarounds. And so what I would say is, that's fine, then do your job and make sure that people, when they stand in front of that court, believe that they come and justice is blind, that they have equal opportunity to present their case. And when somebody is on a junket with a corporation or with an individual that may have a personal stake in that case, there isn't any state court that would allow that I know of. Certainly wouldn't be allowed in the state of North Dakota.
Let's talk about the election. Kamala Harris, what happened?
Oh, me? She didn't get enough votes.
But the popular vote was a lot tighter than people expected.
I think those of us who are Democrats were delusional. We thought she could win with a 70-30 wrong track, right track number for the country, right? And the only reason we thought that is we thought Donald Trump was so horrendous as a choice that, of course, she could go in with a record that people didn't believe reflected their opportunity needs, their economic needs, and she could overcome it. She also didn't have a lot of time. Let's just admit that. And I think, I think that we could go woulda, shoulda, coulda. I think the more important thing for me to say is two things here. Number one, I'm glad it was bigger than what we expected. Because when they're this close, there is always that kind of rancor, and you don't see it this time because people say, okay, the country voted, it's clear that they maybe wanted a different direction. And those of us who are Democrats can say, look, we lost. And so how do we recalibrate? How do we re-message? How do we govern differently to get a majority back of the American people? And I think those are really two important general political responses that you should always have in this spot. And the one thing I will say is this idea that you just carpet bomb everything that Trump wants to do or that the administration wants to do, because that might look good on C-SPAN or it might look good to constituencies, that is the wrong strategy. There may be some things that he wants to do that we agree with. And we should say, we agree with that. The American public wants to see people who are willing to listen, people who are willing to govern together, and then fight when it's important, not fight everything. And so, to me, when the country thinks, 70% of the country thinks you're on the wrong track, and you represent that administration, you coming as close as what she did is pretty remarkable, quite honestly.
Senator Blunt, obviously you're a Republican, but just looking at it as somebody who understands politics and the process, you can't go back in time. But had Joe Biden dropped out perhaps this time last year or even earlier, announcing that he would not run, and allowing a primary process for the Democrats to kind of go through that process, that system to select a nominee, perhaps it would have still been Kamala Harris. If that had happened, I realize it's a big if, would that have changed anything?
I think it would have changed a lot. And I think that's what President Biden should have done. I think it's what everybody expected him to do in 2020, that he would be a bridge to the next generation of leadership. And I think he made an unfortunate decision for his own legacy and for himself. I've known him a long time. I like him. He's the guy who wants to like you, and he wants you to like him. And it works most of the time. But there was a case, you know, where 80 is not the same for everybody. I think it was an unfortunate end to his own incredible career of service that he leaves with this sense of somebody who wasn't up to the job. And if he had announced 2 years ago, if he had, I could give the speech. You know, as many of you had expected and I had hoped for, I ran to get the country back in what I thought was a better place, and I won't be running again. Then you'd have had an open primary process. Unlikely that it would have been the vice president, possible. But you know, there's a reason we don't elect vice presidents. One, they're seen as secondary figures. Two, they have almost all of the negatives of the president that they're serving with and none of the positives. And so with the exception of George H.W. Bush in 1988, the last time we elected a vice president was Martin Van Buren in 1836.
Joe Biden was vice president, but he took
A setting vice president. I mean, Richard Nixon was vice president too. But we have not had a history of this for a reason. And if she had been the nominee, she would have had much more time to think about how you really express your position on issues different from the president you're serving with. Clearly, the issues were in President Trump's favor. The border, the economy, public safety, and he spent not much time talking about the issues. He spent time talking about lots of different things. But the issues were to his advantage, and I think the vice president was never able to really frame those issues in the way she'd have liked to. I served with her for 2 years on the Intel Committee, and I like her. I think she's a talented and smart person, but faced a huge obstacle that at the end of the day was insurmountable.
You also served with her. Was she able to define herself, who she was? Because even as 4 years as vice president, most Americans did not know the Kamala Harris story.
Yeah, I mean, I've known Kamala since she was the Attorney General of California. I'm a former attorney general. We used to all get together, and you know, she's incredibly smart and very, very talented. And you know, it's kind of like the majority leader, right? Your job as vice president isn't to go and openly criticize what you don't agree with the president. It's to be the loyal, you know, spokesperson to get out there and promote the message. And so, you know, when you represent an administration that the country thinks is not doing a good job, is leading the country in the wrong direction, that's a big lift, even if you can define yourself. I have Republican friends who say that the short time span worked in her favor. Who knows? I believe in competition. Okay, this is gonna sound mean. If you're a Democrat from a state like North Dakota, you've been in a few political fights. You've had some tough elections. You've had to walk into a room of people who really don't like you much and at least get a couple of them nodding their heads that they agree with you. And so you have a certain level of political skill that you may not have coming from a deep blue state. You know, if you're running in a primary, your argument is usually you're further to the right or further to the left of your opponent. And so all of that drives your positions that far over. She was in that spot when she ran for president in 2020. And so it was hard to recover from some of the things that were said. So the favorabilities of people who knew her were not high. In fact, she was able, unlike your question, she was able to build her resume. She was able to talk about, but she didn't.
There wasn't a narrative to her life story.
Well, that's right. But you know, at the end of the day, the obligatory position she had to defend the administration and defend the sitting president did not serve her well. And that's why Rory's saying that the Democrats may have gone with somebody who could distance themselves from that administration, saying, yeah, Joe did a good job, but I would have done this differently, I would have handled this differently, and had a lot more credibility.
Like maybe a senator from North Dakota?
No, not her. She's done.
I'm going to summarize. There's a number of questions related to the debt and the deficit. As you know, next year, raising the debt limit is going to be priority one, dealing with the Trump tax cuts, and oh, by the way, a $36 trillion national debt. Do both parties finally come together and say, we're going to work to solve the problem? Republicans have the House, the Senate, the White House, so you have the trioka. Will it happen?
Well, we've shown very little interest about the national debt. There's no question. And you take the big spending programs off the table in every political campaign as it starts. You have to look at Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the structure
defense.
Of all of those. If you hope to balance the budget and do something about it. The debt is ridiculous right now. It's going to catch up with us and has already. We spent more on interest on the debt in this last year than we did to defend the country, which is the single biggest discretionary priority, is defending the country. It's, I think, the number one priority of the federal government. More importantly, just in spending, it's about half of all the discretionary spending, and we spent more on debt, servicing the debt, than we did on that. But something has to be done about it, but you have to have leadership who's willing to say we're going to deal with these big issues if you're going to do something about the debt.
I wrote an op-ed, and the title was, if you want to fix the debt, make it political. When I'm in North Dakota, people say, oh, this debt and deficit. And then they vote for people who will raise it, including me, right? And so we all have to look in the mirror. And the point is, until debt and deficit become a political, by that I mean a voting issue, until the voters really get upset about it, there's really no incentive for anyone to fix it. Because you're going to get a lot more mileage out of handing out the goodies, right? You know, you need this, you need that. And I always pick on general aviation because it's amazing how much power they have. That's your little small airports and people who fly their own planes. They have a lot of money and they have a lot of clout. And so you could point out, and this is what I'm really interested in watching, this administration, to see how they deal with the so-called DOGE. Is that it?
DOGE, yes.
DOGE.
It's a department in name only, Department of Government Efficiency.
You know, let's see what they come up with, because it will at least start the conversation about how we need to be spending money. But there's no mystery to what needs to be done. And we have, I will say this, and Roy knows this better than I do because he's so many years been the healthcare expert. You look at the demographics of this country, and you look at the aging of this country, the single fastest growing problem that we have is medical costs. And how do you deal with the high cost of serving more and more post-65-year-old citizens in this country with quality health care that's affordable for the country? And this is going to, I mean, if you think it's bad now, and we got addicted to cheap money. America was addicted to cheap money. You know, when I was there, money was free. What did I mean by that? The interest rate was lower than inflation. To me, that's free money. But you know what? It's not free anymore, and it shouldn't be free. And so until it becomes a voting issue, debt and deficit won't be solved.
You know, you'd hope it wouldn't take a crisis, but the crisis that's clearly out there is the first major crisis. Could be that year in 32 or 34 when we no longer can honor the Social Security obligations. Now, it doesn't mean you wouldn't get your check, but it might mean you got 80% of your check. And suddenly, this is a real issue to lots of people. And you know, you'd hate to think that that's what it would take for us to get serious about the deficit and the debt issue. But it's not. It'll be here quicker than you think, and we should be ready for it.
And quicker if we don't tax Social Security income tax, because all that money goes into the trust fund. And so it will shorten the time period to, I think it's 2030. if we take away the tax, the income tax.
Or maybe raise the cap. Right now, 156,000 is...
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, this is a mathematical problem. You can solve Social Security. There's no mystery to how to do this. And in fact, when I was... I did a stint at the Institute of Politics over at the University at Harvard. And, you know, we had a hackathon where we had a bunch of really smart kids put together a plan. We had these brilliant plans that students came up with because it's not that hard to solve. What's hard is finding the political will to solve it.
So final question. I've given time to think about it. Speaker Johnson, Leader Thune, President Trump, your advice to the incoming leadership on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue as a Republican?
Get the work done. Get away from trying to govern through executive orders and regulations, and get the work done in the most public way you possibly can.
And to your Democratic leadership?
Pick your fights. Do not talk about everything that's going on. Think about what you want to say and how what you want to do is different than what they want to do, and be very, very clear, but quit the vitriol, quit exaggerating, catastrophizing everything that goes on in America, and get the work done.
Do you miss the Senate?
Love the Senate. Don't miss the Senate.
I had a senator, former senator from Idaho, come up to me and he said, you know, I'm going to tell you a story. When I first left the Senate, people would come up and say, do you miss the Senate? And I would say, oh, yeah, you know, I miss everybody. Now they say, aren't you glad you're not in the Senate? And that to me was absolutely a foretelling of the direction that we're going if we don't, as Americans, demand more of the people that we elect to go to Congress.
Well, we are glad you are here tonight at the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the Study of the U.S. Senate, to Adam Hines and the great staff here, Emily Rupp, everybody who's been putting this together. Thank you very much for joining us, and please come back again. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you all.
Politics of the United States.
For the people of the United States.
This is POTUS.
Sirius XM 124.
And on the Sirius XM app.